Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
I'm joined now in the studio by Ireland's EU Commissioner for Financial Services, Financial Stability and Capital Markets Union, Mairead McGuinness. Good morning to you. Thank you for being here. Now, in Davos last week, the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said that the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, he said it's not an absolute deadline for EU and UK negotiators to reach a deal on the Northern Ireland Protocol. Do you agree with that stance? Do you think he's right?
Yeah, I think it would be nice to have a deal done by a certain date, but I think it would also be more practical to say that we're working and negotiating very effectively now and not to put, if you like, a final date, because there's always the risk that things mightn't happen and that doesn't look good.
I think it also prevents it, though, from dragging on, doesn't
no,
it?
No, I wouldn't agree. I mean, I think we've learned enough since 2016 around Brexit and the protocol not to preempt outcomes. But I think I would say in this new year still of 2023 that there is a wide understanding at EU level and in the United Kingdom that a deal can be done with a lot of effort, notwithstanding all the problems around it. And the fact that we're now in this process of exchanging information, in my view, is a huge step forward. So, I mean, I think the Taoiseach is right in saying if you put a deadline in, it might be a barrier to progress, but it would be nice to think that we could work towards that without putting it on paper and forcing the point. It's also true to say that while I'm optimistic about where we are today, there are lots of other difficulties in these negotiations. But I think the spirit is good between the negotiators, and that's hugely important.
Let's talk about that, because there's a lot of reflection going on, and people might have heard the Taoiseach yesterday on This Week saying that he always accepted concerns unionists have expressed over the protocol. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar saying the protocol was imposed on Northern Ireland without the support of the two communities, and he's reflecting on that. What's the Commission's view on how the protocol was put in place at that time?
I suppose if you look back at history, the protocol was agreed between the United Kingdom and the European Union. But there's always been a sense from the Commission side and Europe generally that we were trying to solve a problem which Brexit had created, which was the possibility of a border on the island of Ireland, which nobody wanted. And in order to do that, you had to look at issues around trade and standards across a whole range of both services and indeed goods. So the detail was agreed. What became problematic was the impact it had in some communities. And I think that Maros Šefčovič, who's my colleague who negotiates this, he's been to Northern Ireland. He talks to everybody, all political parties and none, so communities, business people, to understand how implementing the protocol might cause problems and then to find solutions with his counterpart in the United Kingdom.
That may be happening now and people are thinking about that now and how this is impacting the unionist community. But at the time, and you say the agreement was done between Britain and the EU, the consideration wasn't given to how this would affect the unionist community at that time. Do you accept that now?
I wouldn't agree that fully that no consideration was given. I think, and I repeat this point, that at the time there was a huge problem about what would happen because of Brexit on the island of Ireland. And remember, we're going back to 2016. The details in the protocol were agreed for several reasons, to solve a problem, but also to make sure that Northern Ireland had the best of both worlds. Of course, it's part of the United Kingdom, but also access to the European single market. And that's what the protocol provides. There are, of course, stresses and strains, and some members of the unionist community are deeply upset by it. But I think in 2023, and if you know, the years have flown by, the longer this goes on, it could become very protracted. However, I think we started well this year by agreeing on information sharing, because that was problematic in the beginning. And why it's important is it allows us to see what goods are coming exclusively to Northern Ireland and what goods might be ending up in the single market. And I think that that's a really important piece of the discussions.
I want to ask you about the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's motivation here. We know he's very focused on economic matters. Do you think that his push to fix the protocol is motivated by securing trade deals? And I'm thinking particularly about what Joe Biden said about a potential US trade deal.
I would imagine that the British Prime Minister, and I can't speak for him, so my impression would be that there are lots of difficult issues on everyone's agenda, geopolitical issues. We have the war in Ukraine, we have inflation, etc. But Brexit remains an unsolved issue. He's a new Prime Minister, and perhaps he is trying to set a different path in order to resolve one issue, which is not It isn't a problem that it won't go away unless there's a solution, but the solutions can be found if we are pragmatic about what we're trying to achieve. So go back to what I'm saying here. The best of both worlds for Northern Ireland, business, so that they enjoy huge access, but solving those problems where some in the community, and you say the unionist community, feel that they are less British or less part of the United Kingdom. That was not the objective of the protocol. The protocol was in fact, I suppose, a solution to two problems. Would we deny access to the single market for Northern Ireland? And what impact would that have? And also for the island of Ireland. So there was a huge awareness amongst the European Union of the impacts on a member state, which Ireland is and will remain, but also aware that, you know, Northern Ireland has to be dealt with sensitively. So maybe some of the remarks you quote, just as you have, suggest that perhaps some feel there wasn't enough sensitivity. I have been involved, as you know, for a long time in Europe, but also in the protocol issues. And certainly my conversations with colleagues would also say, look, you have to understand the history, the politics, the difficulties. But equally, I think we need an understanding across all communities in Northern Ireland that what we're doing is for their benefit. Mm-hmm.
But it's probably no harm that Joe Biden said what he did from an EU perspective, because it does move it along and it focuses the mind that if this isn't sorted out, it could sink a US trade deal.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to this issue of trade, because trade is really important, I think there are issues around trade, including as Joe Biden has raised, which does put a focus on what he sees as necessary. I mean, there's also a suggestion that Joe Biden might come for the anniversary. Again, I think these are all speculative pieces. And to some extent, it's really helpful that nobody is saying how this will be solved. But what we're saying is it can be solved. We've taken very good steps in January of 2023 to do that, notwithstanding, as people are saying, the challenges.
What do you think about these opinion polls that show that the majority now in the UK look at Brexit and think this isn't working and it was a mistake? Do you think it might be possible that they will revisit their decision?
Oh, gosh. Well, I haven't given that any thought, because really I think we have to respect that Brexit has happened. Look, in Davos last week and in Europe, people don't think that the United Kingdom will come knocking at the door and say we've made a mistake. And I don't think I'd like to see the United Kingdom do that. We have to respect the vote that happened, even if we were all hoping it would be otherwise. And we have to find a way of working with the United Kingdom as a third country rather than as a full member. But look what we're working, or how we're working together on issues like sanctions, Ukraine. We have the same problems around energy security, inflation. I mean, there are huge economic problems in the United Kingdom. And I would not like to say anything that would suggest that Europe is watching that the United Kingdom will turn up tomorrow or the next day and say, we'd like to get back in. I think we have to settle down now to a new relationship and the future will decide its own course.
Isn't it interesting, though, when you see in a paper like The Telegraph an opinion piece that comes to the conclusion that Brexit is beginning to look slightly rubbish, even pointless?
Well, indeed, that is remarkable, I suppose. If we were to go through all the many headlines, and I made a few myself over the last whatever number of years, you would wonder, you know, what was this about? But I'm also very pragmatic. Despite what's written in newspapers, a decision was taken. A government may decide at some point to change that. I see no sense from the Prime Minister that that will happen. And I think from a European point of view, we have no sense of that, despite what we might hope over time that that will come. I mean, there's been interesting comments, I think, from some who were very pro-Brexit now talking about labour shortages, the impact on the economy. I think that's good that these discussions are taking place. I would have liked that they happened before the vote so that there was a more realisation of what might happen. But I would repeat the point that we have to, in Europe, have to have a very strong relationship with the United Kingdom, as indeed Ireland
has. You mentioned Ukraine. The EU has approved 9 separate sanctions packages. What's left to do?
Well, there are things left to do, and I won't go into any of the details. There are talks beginning on this because we're coming up to the first tragic anniversary of when this war started on February the 24th. Here's how I view the next year. despite, and let's see what happens in terms of the awfulness of this war. We spent last year rolling out 9 sanctions packages. We've never done that at a European level, and we've done it without having all of the architecture that the US have around sanctions. Nonetheless, we've been effective. 2023 is about implementation, and there's several layers to that. That's my responsibility in the Commission, is to help those member states that don't have the infrastructure or the architecture to do the work, so we support and help them. Also trying to make sure that we get all the information flows from our member states to see what's happening around asset seizures. And there is now, because we have appointed an international envoy on sanctions, we're looking at unusual trade flows from Europe and indeed from third countries to Russia. And his job is to focus on circumvention and work with our allies, including the UK and the US, to make sure it isn't happening. Because where there's a war, some will try to profit from it. And where there are sanctions, people will try and break them. Mm-hmm. But they need to be very well aware that it is a crime to do that, and it carries huge consequences.
Okay. It's the first time we've been speaking to you here on the programme since the Cash for Influence scandal broke. And the authorities haven't named the country that they suspect is behind this alleged bribery network. But numerous EU sources have accused Qatar of running the operation. Now, you, as you said at the start of this interview, have been involved in Europe for a very long time as an MEP, Vice President of the European Parliament, a parliament now in commissioner role. Bribes and suitcases full of cash. Is that the parliament? Is that the organisation that you know? Have you ever come across it? Have you ever experienced it?
Never, never. And I mean, shock is too small a word. I know some of these people who are involved and still in jail pending trial. So I think it has shaken the European Parliament to its core. And the President, Roberta Metsola, is addressing that. But it affects all the institutions. I mean, you are talking about millions, apparently, not just hundreds of thousands. It is shocking. You've mentioned the country that's involved. There are other countries that are speculation as well around that. I just try to understand why any member of the European Parliament elected by its citizens would allow itself to be dragged in that direction, which is just disgraceful.
It's hardly really a one-off, disgraceful. Though. And well, we know that lobbying goes on, you know, every day, every hour.
Lobbying and bribery are worlds apart. I mean, bribery and corruption are shocking. Whether it's €1,000 in a suitcase or 100,000 in a suitcase, the fact that there's any cash at all, and remember, I'm responsible for anti-money laundering, so the source of that money is also a concern. For me, the most important lesson of all of this is that good policing works. It wasn't the internal system that discovered this. It was the Belgian police force, clearly had information going back months and meticulously followed through on that. What's important, as I understand it, at this stage of that investigation is that one of those involved is prepared to tell all. So we are going to see, in my view, more emerging from this, and we should. We need to know all of the facts, the countries involved, who else in the parliament is involved. But I know, because I talked to lots of members of the parliament in December when this broke, and I mean, people are just horrified because they feel, look, I'm here, I'm trying to do my job, I know nothing of this, you wouldn't want to go near it with a barge pole. But it taints, and that's the sad part of it.
Your term as commissioner runs out on October next year, isn't it? So you've over a year to run. Have you thought about what you will do next? Will you be putting yourself forward again?
Well, I certainly would at this stage, because it hadn't occurred to me up until now to think about these things. I've been in this role 2 years. We're over halfway through the mandate. Clearly, I came in later into the commission than other colleagues. But the role I have is very important around financial services. It's pivotal to what's happening in Ukraine. And I have a huge amount of work to do in the next few months. But it's a government decision. So regardless of my desires or otherwise, it will be the government that will decide who is the next commissioner. I think what's always interesting from when you look at, and you mentioned the European Parliament, for example, a lot of my colleagues who are commissioners will run for the European Parliament because they're on the list system, and then probably hand over the seat to somebody else and they come back to the commission. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be very straight about it. I had hoped at one point to be a commissioner. I didn't think it would happen. I'm now in the role, and clearly I have good relationships with my colleagues,
so
and indeed
the
president. If asked, of course.
What about the option of becoming President of Ireland?
Oh, well, I think that's further down the line. I mean, it's true I did run for the Fine Gael nomination in the past. Events have changed since then. So I'm a great believer in moving on. As I said, when I put my hand up to be considered for this role, I was prepared to come second. I didn't in the end. I got the job. So I'm very much focused on that. I'm also somebody who believes that if you try plotting and planning your whole life, it doesn't usually work out.
It's not off the agenda either.
Let's see what happens. The agenda at the moment is fairly heavy with what I'm doing now. So perhaps over next Christmas, I might have some time to wind down and think.
Commissioner, thank you for joining us in the studio. That's Commissioner Mairead McGuinness. We'll take a break.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.